Hugh Latimer was a bishop in Worcester, England in the mid-1500s. He lived and ministered during a period of intense conflict between Catholicism and Protestantism in England. And in 1555, Latimer and two others were arrested and questioned specifically about their beliefs concerning the Mass. They were asked if the elements became the true body and blood of Jesus and if the Mass had any power to forgive sins. They staunchly denied both. And over the next several days, they debated with church officials. And each of the three men clearly stated his opposition to Catholic doctrine. Latimer affirmed Jesus alone is the sacrifice of our sin. On the cross, Jesus gave himself as an offering to God, and as a result, and in doing so, he purged the sins of all who rely on him. After that, a warrant was issued against Latimer, which charged him with holding diverse heresies and erroneous and most pernicious opinions. And in his final trial, Latimer affirmed again, Christ made one perfect sacrifice for all the world. Neither can any man offer him again. Neither is there any propitiation for our sins except in his cross only. And Hugh Latimer was condemned to death. 2 weeks later, he and Nicholas Ridley were led to the stake where they were to be burned to death. And at the stake, they were asked if they would recant. And Mr. Ridley answered for them both. He said, I will never deny my Lord Christ and his known truth. God's will be done in me. They were each chained to a stake. And when the fire was lit beneath Ridley, Hugh Latimer turned to him and said, be of good comfort, Master Ridley, and play the man. We shall this day light such a candle by God's grace in England as I trust shall never be put out. The fire was lit under Latimer, and a little while later he cried out, O Father of Heaven, receive my soul. Soon after that he died, without recanting his faith, denying the gospel, or denying Jesus. The book of Daniel records how four faithful men of God faced intense pressure and persecution in an effort to persuade them to renounce God. Despite everything they suffered, they endured. They remained faithful. Last week we considered the first test of their faith. Despite severe emotional and physical trauma, the four men refused to disobey God by eating the king's defiled food. And Daniel chapter 1 concludes the 3 years of training for Daniel. So I know I had you turn to Daniel 2, but actually go back to Daniel 1 verse 17. It says in verse 17, as for these four men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So what it tells us is that Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were given by God great knowledge and skill. And there's more going on here than that they carried a 4.0 throughout their training time. They truly mastered the material. They were given a level of expertise in the subject so that God gave them a deep understanding of what they were being taught. Specifically, it tells us in this verse that God gave them great skill in the Babylonian literature so that they learned to speak and read the language of the Babylonians with great skill. So that part of what they received would, many would consider a postgraduate level of training, a master's or doctoral level of training. And they excelled at it because God gave them wisdom and skill. And it tells us that God gave them great skill in the wisdom of the Babylonians. It's specifically what I think it's referring to. This wisdom of the Babylonians would have included the teachings in how to govern and manage the empire. Remember, these men are being trained to serve Nebuchadnezzar. They would have been his staff or on in his court as officials acting on his behalf. So they were trained how to govern. They would have been taught about the rituals used in the worship of the Babylonian gods. They were instructed in all the laws of Babylon and instructed in the accepted wisdom of how to live. And these four men were given great skill in all the wisdom of Babylon. But in doing so, they never compromised their obedience to God. Remember, chapter 1 has already showed us their commitment to complete obedience to God. And the rest of the book confirms that they learned the wisdom and literature of Babylon without participating in its idolatry or sin. Now, at the end of the 3 years, verse 18, chapter 1 tells us they were examined by Nebuchadnezzar. And in that interview, Nebuchadnezzar found them to be much wiser than all the counselors and magicians and astrologers in his kingdom. And so Nebuchadnezzar appointed them to serve him. Now, at this point, they're not appointed to the highest or most important positions. That's going to come later. They were given a job on Nebuchadnezzar's staff somewhere. It doesn't tell us where. And I think part of this is because even though Daniel and his friends, they had great wisdom and skill, they did not yet have experience in the real world of Babylonian politics. They were still teenagers, at most 17 or 18 years old. And they've had really no experience in any of what they're about to do. And so Nebuchadnezzar put them in a position where they could gain some real-world experience as they served him. And then chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "Now in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams, and his spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him." So Daniel 2 now starts in the second year of King Nebuchadnezzar, with Daniel and his friends newly appointed to their positions in Nebuchadnezzar's court. Now, that first verse of chapter 2, though, raises a problem. If you remember from last week, and I skimmed over it this week, but if you remember from last week, they were given 3 years of training. It tells us in verse 18 that at the end of the days, at the end of the 3 years, they were brought before Nebuchadnezzar and interviewed. Chapter 1 begins the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, and chapter 2 ends with the promotion of Daniel to be chief over the province of Babylon. So how is it possible for Nebuchadnezzar to interview these men at the end of their 3 years of training, discover their great wisdom, and give them positions in his court, but also for Nebuchadnezzar to appoint them to high positions in his empire during the second year of his reign? It seems to us, if reading it like that, as if Daniel is given a very high place in the Babylonian Empire before the king interviews him at the end of his training. And this seems to suggest the history of Daniel is out of order and contradicting himself, so that if Daniel was promoted high in the empire during the king's second year, then the interview at the end of the 3 years of training would not have happened. It's not a contradiction, though. This little calendrical conundrum can be worked out with just a little bit of history. And first historical bit is Nebuchadnezzar was not yet king when he conquered Jerusalem. Nebuchadnezzar's father died while Nebuchadnezzar was leading the campaign in Judea against Egypt. After the defeat of Jerusalem, Nebuchadnezzar hurried back to Babylon to be crowned king. Now, if you remember the first verse of this book, you recall that it says Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And we can't read that as if it was saying Nebuchadnezzar was king of Babylon when he besieged it. It simply does what actually we still do today. It refers to Nebuchadnezzar by his later title. So we can rightly talk about President Washington crossing the Delaware. even though we know he was a general at the time he did it. We can rightly talk about President Reagan starring in Bedtime for Bonzo, even though he was actor Ronald Reagan when that happened. We just, out of respect for the position, we tend to refer to people by the highest title that they attained in their life, even when we're looking at events that happened before they were given that title. That's all the book of Daniel is doing. It's just, when it says Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, it's giving to him that title, the highest title that he had in his life, but he was not yet king when he conquered Jerusalem. And he was crowned king after returning to Babylon. And it's highly unlikely, I think it just didn't happen, that Nebuchadnezzar arrived in Babylon and they crowned him king that day. There would have been a process. And there would have been a very formal procedure they followed there. So very likely, the training of Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah began before Nebuchadnezzar officially took the throne. So they began their training before Nebuchadnezzar became king. And this gives us a little bit of extra time in that training, but it doesn't balance out the 3 years of training with the second year of the king's reign. But there's a second bit of history that brings those numbers into balance. The Babylonians did not count the years of a king's reign the same way we do. And so the Babylonians did not count the year in which a king ascended to the throne. So the ascension year of a king was essentially year zero. What we would call the king's second year, the Babylonians called his first year. What we would call his third year, the Babylonians called his second. Aha. It all balances out. So what you have here is the Hebrew children begin their training before Nebuchadnezzar took the throne. They would have ended their training late in the year that the Babylonians called Nebuchadnezzar's second year. And late in Nebuchadnezzar's second year, they were interviewed by the king, placed in their positions, and then very soon afterwards, still in that second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, these events of chapter 2 take place. Now, I know that's a long digression, but I think it's important for us as we think through things which seem like contradictions in the Bible, that we do not leap to the conclusion that the Bible is somehow mistaken. In part, what we need to do is remember the people who wrote the Bible had different ways of thinking than we do. For example, their year did not begin in January. Depending on the people, it really began all throughout the year. And the different nations had different ways of describing the length of the reigns of their kings. And these differences, I could give a whole bunch more, but these differences do not mean that they were less accurate than we are today. They seem wrong to us because we don't think that way. But when we understand how they thought about these things, we find they were completely accurate. And so when you see some what appears to be a contradiction in the Bible, do some homework to understand how the author and the original readers would have understood what is said. Go pull out a good commentary. Don't Google it. Pull out a good commentary and work through how these original readers would have understood this. Certainly do not assume the Bible is wrong. Assume you do not yet have all the information that you need to understand what the Bible is saying. One night, Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams so troubling, he could not sleep. And the ancient Babylonians believed that the gods spoke through dreams. Consequently, Nebuchadnezzar had to know what the dreams meant. He called his counselors, his wise men, and his diviners to him. He told them he had a dream, and he wanted them to tell him the dream and the meaning of it. And verse 4, one group of these wise men, known as the Chaldeans, they spoke to the king in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation. That's a pretty reasonable request. Tell us the dream, we'll explain it to you. But this is where things get interesting. Nebuchadnezzar refused to tell them his dream. He may have forgotten it. It seemed more likely that he wanted to test his wise men's ability to see if they actually had the supernatural abilities they claimed. But whatever his reason, Nebuchadnezzar refused to tell them the dream. He also said, if they did not tell him the dream and its interpretation, verse 5, you shall be cut in pieces and your houses shall be made an ash heap. He really wanted to know the meaning of the dream. And this was not an idle threat. History tells us Nebuchadnezzar was a ruthless king. He did not hesitate to torture and kill anybody who displeased him. Verse 6, though, he also promised to give them reward and honor. If you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and reward and great honor. And so the wise men, though, in response, they acknowledged they did not know the king's dream, and they could not know it if he didn't tell it to them. They said, verse 7, let the king tell the servants his dream, and we will give its interpretation. And Nebuchadnezzar again refused. Now he accuses them of stalling in hopes that he would calm down a little bit and relax his threats. And then the Chaldeans respond again in verse 10. And this third response sets up the real issue in this chapter. Because right now, so far this seems to be a question of dreams and interpretation. It's a disagreement between the king and his counselors. Maybe it's a test of the counselor's ability, but that's not actually what's happening. None of that is the reason this is in the Bible. What is actually happening is the powerlessness of the pagan gods is being exposed, and the power of the God of heaven is being revealed. And this conflict between pagan gods and true gods is set up by the Chaldeans' response in verse 11 when they say, there is no other who can tell it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. It's a crucial statement here. Really, the story turns on that statement. As the wise men have confessed, they can't know what is in the mind of any man. They did believe their gods knew those things. Unfortunately, the gods of the Babylonians were distant gods who would not reveal secrets to men. The Babylonian gods might sometimes involve themselves in the affairs of men and the kingdoms, but rarely. They did not speak to men and answer to the requests of men. The gods of the Babylonians really did not concern themselves with the problems of the king or the problems of his wise men. The gods of the Babylonians were impersonal, disinterested gods. They could be appeased at times, but they really could not be relied upon or trusted in. The wise men could not know the king's dream, and they had no hope of asking their gods and receiving an answer. And Nebuchadnezzar by this time is furious. He ordered all the wise men in the city of Babylon to be killed. And this extended to all of them, even the ones like Daniel who were not summoned before the king. So Daniel and his friends were not in this audience. As the captain of the king's guard, a man named Arioch, came to Daniel to kill him. And when he showed up at Daniel's door, Daniel asked him, why is the king so hasty? Or maybe harsh in this matter. Arioch explained the situation to Daniel, and Daniel asked for time to tell the interpretation of the dream. And so verse 16, it tells us Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time. I don't think it's saying that Daniel went all the way to Nebuchadnezzar. I think Daniel went into the palace and then through messengers and servants would have asked for more time. And the king granted Daniel's request. So Daniel returned home. He told Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah that the king had given them more time so they could ask God to tell them the king's dream and its meaning. So they prayed. They asked God to be compassionate to them and to save their lives by revealing them to them the dream. God answered their prayer. The book of Daniel is about the sovereignty of God over all people, nations, and circumstances. The God of Israel rules all nations, kings, and events, even when, as in the book of Daniel, it's not obvious. It doesn't look like it. And the God of Israel not only rules all, he is actively involved in people's lives. The God of Israel, the God of the Bible, is not distant and uninvolved like the gods of the pagans. God is not deaf to the prayers of his people, but he is active in individuals' lives. He hears and he answers prayer, and he answered the prayer of these four Hebrews. He revealed to them Nebuchadnezzar's dream and its meaning. Next week, we're going to consider that dream. But before we do that, we need to understand the theological foundation that the book of Daniel establishes for this dream. Remember, the dream was given to Nebuchadnezzar, pagan king, and is revealed through Daniel in the context of and in contrast with pagan worship. So that this revelation of the meaning of the dream to Daniel is contrasted with the silence of the gods of Babylon. This recipient of this dream was one who believed his God was greater than Daniel's God. The one who interpreted the dream knew that his God is the only true God. And in response to God's answer of their prayer, Daniel prays this psalm of praise to God. So let me read verses 20 to 23. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. And he changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might and have now made known to me what we asked of you. For you have made known to us the king's demand." This psalm of praise comes from a subjugated person. It is an island of praise to Jehovah in a sea of idolatry. And in this psalm of praise, Daniel tells us something about his God. And what he tells us about God is an essential summary of what the rest of this book will teach us about God. So that in this psalm of praise, Daniel tells us five things about God. He is the possessor of all wisdom and power. He is the ruler of all plans and times. He is the ruler of all kings and nations. He is the giver of all wisdom. He is the possessor of all knowledge. So let me put that in three theological terms. God is omniscient, God is omnipotent, and God is omnibenevolent. God is all-knowing, all-powerful, all-good. First thing we see here is God is omniscient. Verse 20, Daniel says, wisdom is his. Verse 22, he says he knows what is in the darkness. God possesses all wisdom, all knowledge, so that he knows even all the deep and the hidden things, the things that are in darkness that nobody else knows. In the lives of these four Hebrews at that time, this knowledge of God was especially important. And in fact, the fact that they prayed reveals a little bit about what they believed about the knowledge of God. They believe that because God knows all, he knew the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. Because God knows all, he knows the interpretation of that dream. Because God knows all, he knows Daniel and his friends and their situation. They believed God could see into their circumstances. They believed God could hear and know their prayers in their house. They did not have to go to a temple to pray. They did not have to find a priest to pray for them. But God's knowledge is so complete, he knew them, their thoughts, their desires, and their words in that moment of their need. And when we pray, we are confessing the same thing, that God knows us. He knows our situation. He hears us. But they also believe that God's knowledge is much more than a collection of facts. In fact, he refers to this particularly as wisdom. Google and Facebook may have a lot of data about you. They may know things about you that nobody else knows. However, that knowledge, if it exists, is restricted to spreadsheets and algorithms. That knowledge is not applied to your life in any meaningful way. So that you do not go to a search engine for advice on your next decision. You tell them, this is who I am, this is how much money I have, and this is what I'm deciding between, and you tell me what to do. Because we know these are just collections of facts. There's no wisdom there. And God is not a great celestial computer who has all the information of the universe stored in his memory banks. God is the all-wise knower of all things. His knowledge is both deeply personal and deeply practical. He applies his knowledge to life's situation. And he applies his knowledge rightly. That's a key part of wisdom, is being able to rightly apply what is known. And these four men prayed because they knew God possesses all wisdom. They trusted him to make the decision that was best for them. They trusted him to act wisely in their circumstance. They knew that God is all-knowing and all-wise, and they were convinced that his plan is always best. They believed that God is all-powerful. They says he changes the times and seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. Now, the changing of the times and seasons is not a reference to God's control of the year, in which he causes it to go from spring to summer to fall to winter and back to spring again. Certainly God does rule over the seasons of the year like that, but that's not what Daniel's talking about. Daniel is saying God rules over the periods of life and the times established for the various happenings. So that God rules over the events, the happenings, the circumstances, the cycles of our lives. God rules over the plans we make. God rules over the plans of others, even the plans of kings and empires. So that God puts kings in power at his will, and he removes them according to his will. By his limitless power, God puts a nation in place, and by his limitless power, God overthrows a nation. And this power of God is specifically demonstrated in God's sovereignty. So that God's power is so great that he is the ultimate determiner of who will rule and when. God's power is so great, his will is always accomplished. It should be a deeply comforting thing. No matter how bad we blow it, God's will is always accomplished. God is still working his perfect purposes in all things. God's rule is always absolute. So he says here, God is the only one who sets up and overthrows government. Any decent historian can give the economic and military reasons the Babylonians conquered the Assyrians, the Egyptians, and the Jews. And generally speaking, that their answers would be true, but they would be partial. We've already seen in the first chapter of this book that Babylon was victorious because God gave them the victory. Babylon was the greatest empire in the world at that time. It conquered Jerusalem because God determined it would be so. Nebuchadnezzar was king of the empire at that time because God decreed Nebuchadnezzar would be king. Do you know why President Trump won the most recent presidential election? Because God determined he would. Do you know why President Biden was elected before that? Because God determined he would. We can talk about votes and campaigns, the economy, world politics, moral issues. All of those things are right and proper in their place. But the ultimate and single decider of who is our president is God. He sovereignly appoints kings and presidents. He sovereignly establishes a nation. He determines how long that nation will be in power. So we celebrate 250 years of independence this weekend because God sovereignly established and secured this nation. If we make it another 250 years, it will be because God sovereignly determined to preserve this nation. If we do not make it to 251 years, it will be because God sovereignly determined to overthrow this nation. God is sovereign over all nations. He is sovereign over every event in our lives. Daniel and his friends did not just think that God was working in Nebuchadnezzar and the empire. They prayed and asked God to work specifically in their lives. So God is sovereign over everything. He appoints all things which happen to us. There's nothing that is random or chance or luck. Now, there are many variables that go into the occurrence, but God appoints every event. God is all-powerful, therefore he rules supreme over all of life. Third, God is all good. He always does what is right, and he gives good things to his children. So again, in verse 21, he gives wisdom and knowledge. In verse 22, the goodness of God is made personal. He says, I thank and praise you of God, my fathers. You have given me wisdom and knowledge. Might and have made known to me, for you have made known to us. God gave those four men the answer to their prayer. He gave to them what was necessary for their physical protection. He graciously and generously worked. He heard them because he is good. And God's sovereign rule is a good rule. He pours out goodness on people every day. When he judges nations or peoples, he does so to bring people to repentance. God is always seeking the best for his creation. And all that is for our benefit is from the hand of God. As Christians, we have the incredible promise that all that happens is for our benefit. So we know, no matter what our trials are, we know, no matter what our circumstances are, if you are the child of God, can be absolutely certain God is doing the best for you. He is working your eternal good through all things. Your trials are temporary. Their benefit is forever. God is entirely and always good in all situations. This prayer of these four Hebrews is impressive to me. Not just because of the great theology it contains. I love the theology in it. But this prayer is also impressive because of the faithfulness of the ones praying. Those young men had spent 3 years of intense training. Training that was intended to indoctrinate them in all of the thinking of the Babylonians. Before that, they had been kidnapped, shackled, and dragged far from their homes. They had suffered terrible injury at the hand of the Babylonians. They had every reason to wonder if God was real, to wonder if God had forsaken them, to wonder if God would answer their prayer. And yet through all of that, they remained faithful to God, and the pressure of their circumstances did not push them away from God. The pressure of their circumstances pushed them toward God. Dr. Andrew Brunson was a missionary in Turkey for over 20 years. In 2016, he was arrested and held in a Turkish prison for 2 years. During that time, he had no idea if he was ever going to be released. He was threatened with multiple life sentences, and his fate was entirely in the hands of the king of Turkey, who was bent on making an example of Andrew. He was eventually released and forced to return to America. After his release, he was interviewed by PBS. And the interviewer asked him if during that time, when he did not know if he was ever going to see his family or freedom again, did he ever lose his faith? And Andrew's response was, "I did not lose my faith. I was desperate to hold on to it." And because God rules all things in wisdom, power, and goodness, do not let any circumstances cause you to lose your faith. Because God is all-knowing and all-powerful and all-good, cling to Him. When good things threaten to distract you from God, when hard things tempt you to doubt God, cling tightly to Him. Hold tightly to your faith in all times and in all seasons, because He alone is the author and sovereign of all times and seasons.